Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
It's great.
20. As a radio producer, I would question why you don't have headphones on, but what the fuck do I know?
Basically...
Because you're doing it by sight.
Yeah, I'm doing it by sight.
Right, okay, there. Fair enough.
And also...
Cool.
I can get them out if you don't trust me.
No, it's offensive to me. No, it's fine.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 125. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, touring, and today, podcasting and radio. Richard Melvin is the founder of Dabster, a radio production company based in Edinburgh, who produced the largest amount of comedy radio shows outside of London. Given how we just started, I'm over the moon that the audio came out perfect. We talked about comedy tastes, trends, changes in commissioning processes, how to pitch for ideas, what TV channels are and aren't interested in, as well as what Dabster are and aren't interested in working on, and so much more. I think there were some really interesting footnotes, including our thoughts on Louis C.K. and Eddie Murphy's recently re-released, if you like, Netflix special. We covered so many things, and I felt really excited to be having very open and honest dialogues about the industry with such a key player and an exciting person. So I'm sure you're going to get a lot out of this. Before I hit play, if you're new here, please do not forget to hit that subscribe button. If you're old here, please do consider giving us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do join the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. But for now, this is Richard Melvin.
Right, okay. Well, why did I start Dabster? I started Dabster because I... mainly out of total and utter ignorance of not knowing how hard it would be and how difficult it would be. But I always sort of wanted to start my own production company. And I worked at BBC Radio Scotland. And this is from like 2001 until 2006. And I had a good time there, but I kind of got to 2006. I was senior producer of the Fred McCauley show, which was a morning kind of comedy, morning daily chat show thing. And I loved that show. I loved working on it. But I could see that changes were coming. And I could also see that in Scotland, there was a lot of people didn't ever leave. You know, they got a job and they stayed in that job. And so I thought, well, if I want to, you know, do more interesting things and different things and have a bit more variety, then I'm probably going to need to leave the BBC. That's when I went to speak to my boss at the time, who was the head of radio at BBC Scotland, Jeff Szczesinski, and I said, I'm thinking about setting up a production company. And he said, well, basically all you need is some headed notepaper and a business card and all the other kit you need, you can just hire as you go. So I was like, all right, fine. And they were doing redundancies at the time, and I didn't really understand redundancies. And I heard there was a union meeting where they were talking about redundancies. So I went to the union meeting to find out how I could get redundancy, which was not what the union meeting was about. It was about how to stop redundancies. Right. So it was like, that was a bit strange. So that was why I set it up, because I just wanted to do different things. And I had a few ideas within the BBC and that had been commissioned that I'd made, but I didn't then sort of have any ownership of those ideas. And, you know, and I sort of realized that production, in a sense, was people were producers. You know, so like if you've got a skill set as a producer, you and then there's a program and a format, then you could produce a lot of producers could produce that format. So me and my team, we could produce the Great British Bake Off. you know, we could produce Strictly Come Dancing. You know, we could produce the news quiz because we've got skills as producers. We know how to go about doing that kind of thing. But I didn't want to be one of those sort of producers who was given a gig. Yeah. You know, I wanted it to be my own gig. So that was what I did. So that's why I set up Dabster. And when I set it up, I started the company and then realized how the commissioning process worked and realized it was going to be at least 2 years till I got anything on the radio. So that was a fairly long 2 years. And now that was 13 years ago, nearly 14, 13 and a half years ago. And now where do we stand in the where in the Scottish world? I don't really know. We make comedy radio shows for BBC Radio 4, for BBC Radio Scotland. We make podcasts for various people, including The Guardian, Amnesty International, Stand Comedy Club, The Pleasants. I mean, all of those we're not at the moment, but we have done in the past. And we've now started making TV shows, comedy, stand-up comedy TV show called The Comedy Underground. So I don't know. I think in terms of stand-up comedy, I think we're probably the only company in Scotland who's making real stand-up comedy stuff. We have a lot of stuff going out on Radio 4, and somebody said that we were the biggest producers of network radio comedy outside of London. So that seems like one of those things that looks good on your website but doesn't really mean much.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, what's your relationship like with other production companies out here? Are you, do you work with them often? Is it a competition thing? Is it a friendly competition thing? What's the landscape like for production houses up here?
Well, I think, like, I've always had an attitude that, you know, collaboration is key, you know. So up here, the disappointment here in Scotland is the sort of reduction of opportunities on BBC Radio Scotland. BBC Radio Scotland have sort of had less and less money, and there's been fewer and fewer opportunities. So from terms of radio production, there's, you know, it is quite competitive amongst the radio production companies here. The comedy unit used to have a radio production department that made shows for Radio Scotland and Radio 4, but they couldn't sustain that department, so that kind of closed down. And then there's Demas Productions, but they kind of do a lot more kind of music-y type stuff, so we've got a good relationship with them. We've tried to get gigs away together. And then, I mean, I guess it's quite competitive, but I think because of scale, if, like, we now, when we made our TV show, I did that, I brought in a TV production company called Beezer Studio. So we've now started working together on bigger projects and trying to upscale things. So I think generally it's a good environment here. There's sort of, I think when you look at network stuff, I think that there's enough of it going around, you know, so that there's a desire to work together and encourage each other and support each other. With radio stuff, it's a bit more competitive, particularly with Radio Scotland. But I mean, then there's Radio 4. So, you know, I think there's enough for everyone. But radio's just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, the budgets are going down and down and down. So everybody's kind of, you know, that does get quite competitive.
As an I'm going to call myself an outsider for this because I live in London. From my perspective, that's the most interesting part of that is the fact there's less or fewer opportunities on BBC Radio Scotland because, you know, although we have a BBC Radio London, it's obviously probably the most competitive one to get onto at any, mm-hmm. in any, you know, part of the country. Whereas, you know, I think BBC Radio Wales, for example, are doing a lot of stuff to support the Welsh comedy circuit. And so, and same with the Midlands, I've seen, you know, there's a few shows. I think Dave, the guy who runs Leicester, Jeff Rowe, has now got like a show on there and like is working on radio stuff there. So it feels like locally, from an outsider point of view, radio is supporting the scene more. But is it, you've noticed that it's a budgetary thing then, is it?
Yeah, but I mean, I think in terms of BBC Scotland, there's more opportunities now in Scotland than there ever has been with the launch of this new TV channel.
Right.
So I just feel like with Radio Scotland, if you go back 10 years, there was more stuff was up for grabs for the independent circuit. You know, now at the comedy that's on BBC Radio Scotland is Breaking the News, which is on 30 weeks of the year, which is an in-house production and is a fantastic program. And then when it's not on air, for the last 5 years, we've made the show that's on its place. So Breaking the News is on for 10 weeks and then we make a show for 6 weeks and then Breaking the News for 10 weeks and then we made it. So that, from our point of view, has been great, you know, because we've done 4 or 5 series of a thing called Stop the Press and now we're just about to do a second series of a thing called The Good, the Bad and the Unexpected. But there's not been a lot of other comedy opportunities. There's been a thing called Saddled, which was a sort of pilot for a sitcom, which I think's just been commissioned. But it's just because we're going through this period of big change in Scotland from the for the BBC. And what I mean by that is that there's no longer a head of Radio Scotland. You know, like there's just basically BBC Scotland is now trying to, which I'm sure everywhere is doing, but it's like there's a head of BBC Scotland, and then there's like a head of sport and a head of news and a head of comedy and a head of factual and a head of entertainment and a head of live events, and they're all looking at platforms, you know, so social media platform, radio platform, TV platform. So for example, our Comedy Underground TV show was also a podcast, and Breaking the News, which has been a radio show for 6-7 years, the last series was they filmed it and they put it on the new BBC Scotland channel. So it's, I think it's bi-media or something they're calling it. So I think there's still loads of opportunities, but in terms of what it used to be like on Radio Scotland, they used to do a commissioning round, used to be able to get lots of things away, and now it just seems that they've got less money in that traditional commissioning sense. But I think there's more opportunities generally as programme makers in Scotland than there ever has been. But in London, I mean, I'm not taking that from being an outsider. I mean, in London, I'm sure BBC London is quite difficult to get onto, but I mean, 80% of everything's made in London, so,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but then there's, I know for every one show that gets made, there's probably 1,000 people who like I've tried to pitch for. I mean, you know, I've been fairly lucky with pitches, and I don't have an agent or any sort of team, which from when I talk to people, you know, having meetings with the BBC and having, we talked about previously before, the time capsule and stuff, you know, being able to go in and actually have conversations with them. I know a lot of people who have sent in emails and sent in things and not even heard, and not heard back, which is understandable because the amount they'll be getting, they can't reply to everyone.
But there's a pretty set route of commissioning, like Radio 4 has a very set route of, you know, the commissioning rounds and having to submit ideas and having to be an approved supplier, you know, which I kind of have understood that as going into TV again. You know, and the way I got into doing all that stuff was when I first started, I wasn't an approved supplier because I didn't have any track record of making shows. So they're not going to give you a bunch of money to make a show if you don't have any track record. So I ended up working with other production companies. So would go to them with an idea and then work with them and then get it commissioned as a co-production. And then the next year I could do it on my own. So, and we're kind of doing that with TV at the moment as well. Like the TV stuff, we're working in conjunction with another company, and I would like to keep doing that, but ultimately our aim would be to do it on our own. You know, so the Radio 4 statistic is that they do, for the comedy commissioning round, they say that they each commissioning round they get, because you have to put in your short paragraph first, they say they get 3,500 ideas pitched to them, and then they shortlist 350, and then they commission 35. So that's a 1 in 1,000 chance. You know, is that right?
Yeah, it's something like, it's still, I mean, it's still not as high as I think people think it is. You know, I don't know how many performers there are in the country on every, if you took every level, but I think people think there's hundreds of thousands of them, and I don't think there are, because it's,
you know, you can work it out, because if you look, I mean, the thing is, it's all published, you know, the BBC stuff. So if you go and look at the BBC commissioning website, and you go and look at Radio 4's commissioning round for last year, for the last commissioning round, which we're waiting for results for at the moment. But if you were to look at that, they say, right, we are looking for shows in this slot at 11 o'clock, we're looking for shows at this slot at 6:30, and we've got, and they'll say something like, we have 12 half hours at 6:30, and that's all that they're looking for the year. You know, that's it, you know. And then at 11 o'clock they might say, we've got, you know, the opportunity for, you know, 12 new series or something. But when you actually sit there and sort of work out what's on offer, you know, it's tiny.
What I found really interesting was when I was talking to, I think it was Chris Sussman about this, he was saying the biggest frustration we have is, so say BBC Two, no one aims for the prime time slot for that, which is why we often recommission stuff that's, you know, good, and we would put it in, but it's just we haven't got anything to replace it with, and no one's sort of, so like with Mrs. Brown's Boys, for example, he was saying, you know, a big reason why that, aside from its popularity, the big reason why that doesn't move is because we don't get many ideas that would rival it or even would even compete with it. And so you think, if you've not looked, if they put something out and they go, we're actually looking for something for that time slot, and you send something in, it's like, no, it'd be like an afternoon tea thing, and they're not looking for that. Of course they're not going to get back to you.
Yeah, exactly. That, I mean, I think that about every time, I think whenever anybody asks me about program making, it's like, you can have all the best ideas in the world, but if they're not looking for it, you know, it's like, you can know, if they're not looking for that sort of thing, you know. And they're, I think they're quite good at giving you that guidance, the commissioners. And the good thing about, you know, the commissioners, I think the more your relationship with them develops, the better they are at saying no.
Yeah.
You know, and that's half the time. 99 out of 100 things go nowhere. So you just want them to say no quickly.
Yes.
Just take it out the back and shoot it in the head. Come on. Don't put me through this misery anymore.
Completely. Yeah. And I think just to qualify what you mean by that to maybe people who haven't got a no or even sent something in. For me, I like the fact that the no, it goes no but. Or it goes no, however, and then they qualify it with something else. Whereas, you know, I think a lot of people get, so like with the BBC competition, for example, there's an automated no email, and not many people follow that up by saying, can I just have a bit of information? And then they normally, and that normally starts your relationship with them in a weird way where they go, oh yeah, actually this person's, you know, taking it seriously.
what competition? Is that the stand-up competition?
The New Act one they run? Yeah. Because if you email them in at the right time of the year, you know, when they're not doing all the stuff, they will give you feedback, or they usually give you a bit of feedback, and that's quite helpful because it means that, you know, it could even be something like you emailed number 1,000 and we have 200 people and we just don't have space for you. And that's good to know.
And
it's the same thing with, I'm not going to bring it up too much, but the time capsule I was saying with you before, they had too many interview programs.
Yeah, absolutely. And they've said that for a long time. They're not looking for interview programs.
Yeah.
You know? They were in the last commissioning round.
Yeah.
They were looking for one-to-one interview programs.
I should have looked that up. I didn't bother looking it up because I just assumed they were going to say no again.
But I think that was mostly to do with, you know, if you read between the lines, is, you know, a reduction of budget.
Yeah, because they're quite cheap to make.
Cheaper anyway.
Yeah, by comparison to other things anyway. So I was going to ask how you scout for ideas.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, scouting for ideas is one way. I mean, if you think about the size of company that we are, there's only four of us. Most of the idea, to be honest, like, this is a kind of failing of our company. Most of the ideas that we make are our own idea to a certain extent. If somebody comes up to me with an, you know, but we over time, it's taken me a long time to realize this, you know, over time we've developed a few ideas that we are at a point now where they're getting recommissioned, you know, so we're working on that stuff. Ideas that we put into the commissioning round tend to generally be, this is the thing that I've learned, the biggest, most important lesson I've learned, I think, is the fact that a commissioner at a channel or a radio station or a TV station is going to look at you and go, is your company able to deliver this on time and on budget and to the brief? So therefore, there's no point in a company like mine who has a track record in making stand-up comedy shows for TV and radio pitching a Mrs. Brown's Boy style sitcom, because they're just going to look at us and go, well, you're not going to be able to make that. You don't have the infrastructure, the experience, or any of those kind of things. So we're not going to give you £250,000 an hour to make, you know, 6 hours of TV. It's just not going to happen. So we tend to pitch stuff that the commissioner's going to look at and go, yes, that company can deliver that. They will deliver it, and they know how to, you know, so that makes it us kind of like really sort of be developing our own stuff, you know. So sometimes people come to me with an idea and I'll go, yeah, that's a really good idea, let me have a think about it. And if there's something, I'm trying to think of an example of that, but mostly it's stuff where I'll see somebody. So, you know, the prime example, you know, of a Radio 4, our first Radio 4 idea was, I went to New York to make a show for Radio Scotland called Dean Friedman's Real American Folk, and I was out there with Dean, and he had a guy on his show called Latch, and I went to see Latch in New York, and he was really cool, I really liked him. And then he came over to the UK because he was touring, he was a musician, and I saw him twice on his tour of the UK, and I thought he was really cool, so I chatted to him and I said, you should come over to the Fringe. So I ended up producing a show with him at the Fringe, which we put together, you know, we wrote it because he was a musician, but every time I saw him he was telling funny stories between the songs, so I was like, well, let's work on those funny stories because they're really good. And we put together a show that only had four songs in it and the rest was talking, and that was called The Day I Went Insane. And then we put that together, and that then ended up being commissioned by Radio 4 as The Latch Chronicles, right? And that was our first Radio 4 commission, and we ended up doing three series of that. And that was, you know, developing an idea with him, seeing him perform, developing an idea with him. Another example of the same sort of thing is, like, I started off doing a podcast called the Live at the Stand podcast, and it was me presenting it, bits of stand-up, interviews backstage. It was back in 2009, 2010, when there wasn't that many podcasts. Frankie Boyle was one of our guests, and he said, can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah.
Well, he said...
Is that what he said?
Or no, okay, he didn't say that. No, he said the festival, he goes, I'm not going to do the festival because the festival is just a cunt soup with loads of people who just want to be, want to get on panel shows and be cunts like me. And then He said that just at the time he stopped doing Mock the Week.
Can I just quickly say that, like, when you said cunt soup, you were waving so politely at
I know, someone. I was waving, I was waving out my window. We're in my living room here in Edinburgh, and two of my kids' friends just walked past.
It was a real
I was waving at, like, a 12-year-old and an 11-year-old saying going, cunt soup.
It was a real juxtaposition for me to watch, and I was like, I really want to laugh at this, but I don't want to ruin your flow.
But anyway, he said, he told that story in the podcast. It got picked up by the Sun newspaper. It was on the front of the Sun. The podcast went nuts. It was at number one in the podcast charts for, like, 2 months or something. It ended up getting about 5 million downloads. But that led us to doing a show called where Radio Scotland picked it up, and it was at a time when I was working with Sarah Millican, who was a newcomer that year at The Fringe, and she hosted the show for me for Radio 4 for Radio Scotland called Sarah at the Stand, it was called. And then we did three series of that for Radio Scotland, and it got picked up by Radio 4 Extra, and then we did a show called 4 Extra Stands Up, and now we're just doing a series called Fred at the Stand, which is with Fred McCauley, which is on Radio 4, primetime Radio 4, and that all started from that podcast, you know, and that's something that we're about to do a third series of that. So then there's Terry Alderton, you know, who we've done lots of series with, who I saw perform. Him and I became very good friends, and then we worked on lots of stuff together, and we've just done 6:30 show on Radio 4 with him, and we're going to be doing another series with him. So those are the ways that I develop ideas, really. You know, I did a lot of stuff with Julia Sutherland about mental health, comedy and mental health, and we did like 7 or 8 series of The Funny Life of Feeling Kind of Funny, these kind of series with her, you know. So, and then the TV show that we've done has been a natural progression of that kind of stand-up stuff. So when it comes to how do you scout for ideas, I kind of guess it's just when I see somebody perform who I think is a compelling performer. So I really like Janie Godley, so I'm wanting to do more work with Janie Godley. I've done some stuff with Ashley Story, her daughter, you know. It's people like that who I feel I could work with and could work with us, and we could come up with something together. I'm not very good if somebody sends me an idea and says, here's an idea, do you want to make this? It's like, no, I don't want to make this, because that, back to what I said at the start, sort of why I left the BBC. I don't really want to produce, and because I think I'm an old-fashioned producer of being really hands-on and writing and directing and creating and shaping and molding, you know. So I'm not very good at, if somebody comes to me and says, here's an idea, would you like to make it? I'm much better if somebody says, I'm a really interesting performer, would you like to sit down and see if there's something we could do together? You know, that's more where I am. So this Fringe, I'm going to be going and seeing as much stuff as possible, because hopefully we're going to do another series of our stand-up TV show. We had 60 comedians on that for a first stand-up show that was made in Scotland for nearly 20 years. We're doing 2 episodes of 4 Extra Stands Up, which is the kind of best of the festival stand-up show for Radio 4 Extra. We're doing 2 episodes of that. So I just want to see as much stand-up as possible and hope from that something will come up. Like the other one being John Maloney, you know, I had him as a guest on a podcast, and then we put him on 4 Extra Stands Up, and then from that I could see how his head worked, and we ended up doing a series called The John Maloney Show, which we're now, series 4 is just about to start in 2 weeks, I think, or a week, 7th of August, whenever that is, quite soon. That's quite soon. I don't want to timestamp this podcast. Timeless.
Be after Edinburgh.
Well, it'll be on the iPlayer. John Maloney's just been on.
As I said, everything will be linked in the show.
It'll be linked in the show, yeah. So that's on.
Because I don't do any editing in the month of August.
Yeah, that's fine. No, that's fine. Well, the other thing I was going to say was, I mean, I don't know if I'm talking too much. Stop me if I am talking too much. I feel I am, but...
I was going to say, I should stop mentioning it on the podcast, because I know it won't be out. I've got a plan to start a podcast network, essentially, because I keep talking to other podcasters who are like, I've reached a level, I've plateaued, I keep getting, you know, maybe get a spike on an episode every now and then, but I don't know where I go from here. And I'm with the Acast Network, which is great for what they do, and I love how they do, you know, monetize it and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I don't actually make enough money off of it, but it's great to have something coming in.
Yeah.
But for me, I want to do a collaborative podcast network that I'm working on, that means that we can share audiences, we can, you know, share contacts with guests, and we can kind of build a profile for sort of, let's say, half a dozen to start with podcasts, and then bring in more people, you know, sort of like the All Things Network in All Comedy, All Things Comedy Network in Bill Burr's thing in America, like that, where it's literally, you know, we know what we're doing, we're not a production house, because we're individually making the production stuff, but to start off with, we're just doing that, and everyone that I've spoken to about that, most of the time I get, you know, when I mention it on this, I get 2 or 3 emails every time I mention it, and someone will go, oh, listen to this then, and I'm a bit like the same as you. I'm like, can we chat? Because like, you might be great at producing a show, but it's like, if I'm gonna have to work with you, or if I'm gonna do something with you, it's a bit it's a bit odd. It's a bit like that guy I told you I got that email saying, oh, can you come? I want to get an agent this fringe. Right. I'm a bit like, I personally wouldn't approach an agent like that. I would meet them for a drink, see if I get on with them, and then see what they actually do and don't do.
Yeah.
And then I'd approach them rather than sort of just randomly emailing people, because you know what I mean? Like, I'm in this, I say this a lot recently because I'm about to, you know, hit 9 years into comedy. I'm in this for the long run. I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So you sort of think, if you're in this for the long run, why would you try and just quickly grab people? You know, it's like, it's a long term, you know, I wouldn't have had those meetings last year with the BBC if I hadn't have, you know, invested in chatting to them and meeting them and having coffee with them 2 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and do you, how often do you gig then now? I mean, do you gig all every week, like every weekend? And so you said you just done a Scottish run. Was that with a Scottish promoter?
No, that was with four different people. So Mark Christie was Aberdeen and Peterhead.
Right.
He runs a lot of the stuff up there. Lewis runs the venue in Dundee that I did. And then the Creef one was the Creef Comedy Festival.
Right, okay.
And that's new. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's quite a new one. So and that was Jim... Oh, his last name's gone from my head, but that I'm sorry, Jim.
Sorry.
But yeah, so that's that sort of thing that I do with my own show. So I did 37 previews this year.
Wow. So your show's good to go on Friday.
It's on rails at the moment.
Okay.
I keep forgetting middle bits, which is always my biggest problem. So maybe if you're going to come see it, see it.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, so I'm looking forward to that, and. Yeah, I mean, I take this festival quite seriously.
Yeah.
And so I want it to be ready by the time I come up here. But also, I do play around with it as much as I can, because I don't want it to just be talking at people.
Yeah, yeah.
My director, John Gordillo, is my director. And and that came out of meeting him a couple of times and, you know, becoming friendly. And he gave me... One bit of advice he said to me was, your problem is... your problem is you sound like a comedian.
Right.
And I was like, I don't think that's a problem. And he was like, no, the problem is that you sound funnier when you talk as a person rather than a comedian.
Yeah.
A lot of people who try and sound like, they hear comedians and they sound like
follow the rhythm. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, your rhythm is when you just talk is a lot more funny, and it's a lot more endearing as a person when you're talking as you. So what I've tried to do in the last 37 previews over the last 6 months is unlearn
my
rhythm and learn a new one.
Yeah.
So that,
well, that's the whole thing, isn't it? I mean, that's the like that's the thing I sort of detest most about stand up is when people say things like, oh, I told that joke the other night in Bristol and it killed, or, you know, oh, somebody, I was talking to somebody in the audience the other day and they said, or you know, and I'm like, well, I want this to feel like this is the first time you've ever said it.
Yes.
And this, it's only just occurred to you, you know, because I think people still believe that. The majority of audiences still believe that.
Yeah.
You know, the first comedian I really fell in love with was probably in about, I mean, live.
Mm.
I mean, the first comedian I ever saw live was Bob Monkhouse. And that was when I was about 12 at the Fairfield Halls in Croydon. But when I first started coming to see stuff at the festival, I went to see Dennis Leary in the Wildman room at the Assembly Rooms. And it must have been 91 or something like that. And he was amazing. And it was the No Cure for Cancer show. Mm. And it was this tiny room in Edinburgh that he did. And he was just sitting there smoking all the time. And it was unbelievable. And then he came back the next year and he did a bigger room. And I went to see it. And I was so stunned that it was the same. You know, I couldn't believe that it was like, because back in those days, I had a sort of knack for being able to remember stand up, like word for word, you know, before my brain turned to mush. But and I could remember it word for word. And then I remember sitting there watching it going, this is exactly the same. Like, I couldn't get over it, you know. Yeah. And that was suddenly when the spell was broken.
Mm.
I mean, the same year I went to see Bill Hicks.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw Bill Hicks at the Spiegel tent in the Meadows. And I mean, I loved it. But I remember very, very much thinking, he's a bit Dennis Leary, you know, like he's a bit close to Dennis Leary, and thinking that Bill Hicks had ripped off Dennis Leary. But as time told, it was obviously the other way around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. For me, the worst, I mean, they say the 40-minute lull. You know, that thing in an hour show, there's that 40-minute lull. And I think the only reason that exists is because you are talking at an audience. You are not talking with the audience.
Yeah.
And because you know, we've all got short attention spans. We've all, you know, sort of, by that point, I think everyone's going, should I check my phone?
Yeah,
I feel like I
should
check my phone. Because I haven't checked it in half an hour, 40 minutes. And I don't think it's, I'm not putting down anyone, but the shows that I like going to see are the ones that there's a frisson, is that the right word? Yeah. There's that thing of, oh, they're not, this is for me. this is just me and them in the room. Yeah. This is never going to happen again. And I mean, one of my favorite lines in my current show, which I either do at a person if they look like they're confused, or I do it to everyone, is like, I know my vibe. It's like I've just discovered my own jokes. And it always makes everyone in the room go, oh, that's what he's doing. Like, right, that's right, what he's right, doing. Right, right. Because I play it like I'm talking it out the whole right. the whole time. You know, yeah. Someone came up to me after a preview a few days ago and they said, I don't know why you keep looking up. Like, because I look up a lot.
Yeah.
And as if like I'm not looking at the audience. He's like, I felt disconnected when you do that. And I was like, no, I'm just remembering where I'm at with it. And yeah. then someone else came up behind him and he went, oh, no, I really like that, because it felt like you were trying to work out the idea yourself on stage.
Yeah, right.
And it's stuff like that. But I know what you mean. At this yeah. festival, so many people come with, and like Frankie Boyle said, people come with a thing and they're like, I just want to be on TV. I want to yeah. sell this as a yeah, product. Yeah, I want to yeah. get it as a Soho thing. I want to, you know, yeah. get my Netflix special. And yeah. that's fine if yeah, that's what yeah, you want to yeah. do. But the best comedians I've seen are yeah. not the ones that have a Netflix special.
Yeah.
Not putting down Netflix specials
no,
at all.
No. Well, I remember seeing Jimmy Carr when he first came here, and you know, the first year he came, like, just being an absolute sensation at this fringe, you know. And I saw the first time I saw him, I went to see a show in 2001 called Rubberneckers above the Cafe Royal,
right?
And it was Stephen Merchant, Ricky Gervais, Robin Ince, and Jimmy Carr, four of them doing an hour between them. And Ricky Gervais, it was before the Office had been on TV. But The Office was like one of those things that it went on. I'm pretty sure I was away traveling that year, so I'd missed the whole thing. I came back and I missed Pop Idol, and The Office had passed me by. And what I remember, The Office, just having no idea what The Office was, but I had got a job at Radio 4th, and managed to get in to see this show. And first I've ever saw Ricky Gervais. He was doing the character Derek. And this was 2001. And then Stephen Merchant was doing stand-up and Robin it. And then Jimmy Carr. But Jimmy Carr was clearly the star of those four, you know, because he was just the funniest. He just was absolutely hilarious. And but The Office was one of those things that The Office went on at like 11 o'clock on a Tuesday night on BBC Two. People watched it. It then won 7 BAFTAs. And then they repeated it. And then everybody watched it.
Mm.
So it wasn't actually... You're looking at me blankly, Luke, because I forget how young you are.
Yeah,
how
fine.
Old are you?
I'm not young, but I'm not old. Let's put
so
it
So 2001. Yeah, how old were you in 2001?
That'd have to be a maths question. I'm 32.
32. Oh, how old are you? Okay, I'm 45.
45. You're not that much older.
No, not that
we're
much
in the
older.
Same tick box.
I don't know now. 45. I think I'm 45 to 54 now.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
I thought it was 30 to 45. Sorry, yeah, my bad.
I don't know. 45. I think I'm in there anyway.
It's not that far ahead.
Yeah. So, but Jimmy Carr, and he was amazing. And everywhere you went, there was Jimmy Carr. You know, at Late and Live, every show you saw, yeah. Jimmy Carr. And then the next year, he came back, and his show was called Barefaced Ambition.
Yeah.
And that was just, he was just like, I want a TV show. I just was like, straight balls out. I want the best agent going. I want a TV show. You know. And he left the Fringe with all of that. You know. And fair play to him.
Yeah. I find it really interesting, because here's the thing, maybe 5 people will get a TV thing from this festival, and there's thousands of us doing it. So, you know, yes, have that ambition if you want it, but there's ways to get that. And I think a lot of people, I mean, I won't mention the comedian's name because it's not fair, but I got a text from my friend the other day saying, I know I've left it late, but are there any press people that I should email to come see my show because I want to get a review? And I'm like, mate, it's the... What's today? It's the 29th? It was the 27th-ish.
Yeah.
I was like, I could give you my list, but I don't think it's going to help you at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's too late in the game. But this is part of the reason why I started this, is because, you know, I realised I don't have an agent. I don't have a review. You know, I've got to learn how this works. And it's probably the same way you did it, where you sort of, not latched on, but you went into and were part of another production house to learn it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that to me is really interesting in the sense that, you know...
Well, it's just that's the way of like, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Of like, I think what you're doing is really interesting in that concept of finding an audience, you know, because there are comedians, you know, who, so if we're putting together a show, you know, of like people doing 10 minute spots or whatever, you know, coming on and doing a 10 minute, you know, there's certain comedians we would never work with to do that because they've forgotten how to do that.
Yeah.
And they've got absolutely no need to do that whatsoever. You know, and I think about people like Richard Herring and like Mark Watson, you know, like fantastic comics, fantastic, but they've built their own audience and they talk to their audience, you know. Richard Herring's doing 450-seater Newtown Theatre with his podcast, and it's pretty much all sold out, you know. Which is incredible. And he's found his audience. He's worked really hard to do it, and he's now making a living, a great living, and he's doing it. And I've got so much respect for that. You know, so much respect for, you know, Mark Watson as well, in the way that he's sort of found his people. He speaks to his people. You know, Mark Watson doesn't want to go and do fucking 20 minutes at the Glee Club in Birmingham. Do you know what I mean?
But this is, I mean, every new performer that I talk to, they say to me, you know, what's a bit of advice? You know, there's all this sort of thing. And I always say, you know, be funny, find your audience. That's your only job, right? If you want to get someone else involved and you want to go on TV and all that stuff, that complicates it. But if you want to do this job, all you've got to do is be funny and then find an audience for that funny.
That's true.
After that, everything else is kind of optional. Because people conflate the two now, because you do stand up on TV or you do stand up on radio or whatever. And obviously those are great outlets for things, but ultimately the job is live.
Absolutely. And doing my experience with the people I work with, having a 4-part series on Radio 4 will not change your life in any way, shape or form. You'll get paid money to do it, good money, you know.
But will it bring in more people?
But no. And like the thing is like people say to me, if I come and do Fred at the Stand on Radio 4, am I burning a bit of material? And absolutely not. Because the chances of you being in a comedy club where somebody heard that show, there might be 1 in 10 gigs you do, you might have one person in there who heard the radio show. But almost on the TV seems, I think if you're doing Live at the Apollo, then, you know, but that's why you get paid so much to do Live at the Apollo, you know? So
I think it's like, it varies.
I think it varies. Between depending on how experienced you are and what have you, but I think it's from about 15 up to about 30.
Yeah, it's crazy. This is the weird thing, is because, you know, from doing this, I talked to I had a theater email me before I came up here and said, we love it, would you like to do live ones? And I was like, I've done a couple of live ones. I've never thought about doing one in a theater though. And so we've booked one in and we're gonna see how it goes. And now I've had to start talking to guests in a different way, you know, like famous people, and say, how much is it for you to come and do it, rather than sort of, you know, because obviously I've got to sell tickets for that, so they're going to want money from, so it's a whole different dynamic than this when we're just sat in your living room. And that's really opened my eyes. So I'm thinking, like, you know, Herring's thing is so well oiled as a machine.
I wonder how much he pays people, to be honest.
250. Yeah, it's a flat fee. I don't know if it's gone up or not, but I remember it being 250. Because he mentioned it on my podcast. He said everyone gets 250 quid,
which is fine. You know, that's fine.
Because
you come on the radio, to do a spot on the radio. That's about what you get paid for doing that.
But they do it as a. So I mean, he does them in the afternoon on like a Sunday. So if you go into London to the Leicester Square one, for example, you do, you know, 2 hours of a record, you know, do backstage footage and all that sort of stuff, because he does that now. 250 quid, and then you go and do a gig. You know, you could make a really good amount of money in that. Even if you were doing, you know, a middle spot somewhere, you know, you can make it in time. So it's just interesting. I was gonna ask your relationship with the BBC, but it sounds like it's been built up over so much time. It might be a
My relationship with the BBC is really good. I mean, I've got, you know, the BBC are a huge important part of our income, probably 60%. And I have a relationship with 3 people at the BBC. The BBC Radio Scotland, BBC Scotland's TV commissioner, and Radio 4 commissioner. And those are the people that currently, and for the last 2 or 3 years, we've been doing work with. Now, I had a very good relationship with the previous head of Radio Scotland, but then he left. So you then go back to the beginning and sort of have to start again, making a new relationship. Same with the Caroline Raphael, who used to be the commissioning editor for Radio 4. She really helped us when we first started off, and then she left. But the new commissioner's great. But, you know, it takes time to build that relationship up and that trust and what have you. So my relationship with the BBC is good. I mean, I feel that the BBC are doing their very, very best in challenging circumstances, know, and I think that they're making the best programs they can. And this is the people who are in those jobs doing their best work. That's it. No one's putting anything on that they think is rubbish. They're finding the best stuff they can for the budget and timescales available. And I've got nothing but respect for that. I think that, you know, the way the machine works is frustrating, but I think it's frustrating for everyone. I think that there's sort of a resistance, in some cases, a resistance to change. But look at what they're having to do. The new TV channel in Scotland, you know, having to master the kind of online world of podcasts and stuff, having to come up with social media content and what have you, you know. I mean, I give you an example for what the BBC is currently up against. Is last year, Dick and Dom came to Edinburgh Festival. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I managed to get tickets for my kids and their friends. And one friend came along, and like the kids were like, Dick, because they're still on CBBC now, Dick and Dom, right? They have like, they're still on. And the show, one of the guys, a couple of the kids had never heard of them because they didn't really watch CBBC. But one of these 11-year-olds, not only had he never heard of Dick and Dom, he had never heard of CBBC.
Really?
Because everything he watches on YouTube. So he's never heard of CBBC. So the BBC are, you know, backs against the wall. You know, they've never been in this situation before. Yeah. You know, Netflix, Amazon Prime, you know, no one predicted the revolution, the broadband revolution, you know, and that's when you just look back to 10 years ago, 12 years ago, whenever, when the BBC were like, probably longer actually, but were launching like a news channel, a BBC Three, a BBC Four, a CBBC, CBBC. Why? You know, like no one gives a shit about a TV channel. You know, we just want it on our iPads phones, and on our screens and on our phones, you know, and I think they're moving more towards that. But in Scotland, with this new BBC Scotland channel, I mean, the BBC Scotland channels, you know, it's a great thing for us programme makers. But I mean, a channel? I mean, why didn't we just get more of a BBC Scotland presence on the iPlayer? I mean, I don't know, you know. But maybe that's what they're building up to.
Yeah. In terms of content and online content, I find it really interesting that it's been such a slow adoption for, you know, like, the, you know, there's the iPlayer and there's 4OD and there's those sorts of things. But the whole element, I mean, I suppose because they don't have the rights to some content, so they can't put it online because it wasn't covered when they bought, you know, the idea. So I get why the thing's taken so long. But given that, you know, people are humans who work in the office, and they obviously, you know, will have Netflix and they'll have, you know, they'll want to watch stuff online. But YouTube's been around for so long that I felt like that was that built, especially when our podcast came out, I felt like the building of it would embed in company, you know, like companies like the BBC and stuff quicker.
Well, I mean, I think the iPlayer came about before, and certainly in this country, before Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
So I think the iPlayer, you know, I think they've done, I mean,
they've done well.
But it's that thing, isn't it, of like, the criticism is like, you know, that's, the iPlayer is funded by, you know, publicly funded. So therefore, and I don't know what was the upshot of that, but like, the technology should be made available to, the technology should be made available to ITV and Channel 4 and all that to be able to use the same sort of technology. I don't know what we're talking about anymore. Okay. I've lost track.
Well, I was going to ask, because I hope it would lead into this. So say you had an idea for a show, right? So, and you took it to the BBC and they were like, not this year, or whatever no they gave you. Would you ever consider making it as an independent podcast so that you could show them that there's an audience for it? Or,
well,
however, yeah.
I mean, I think, I don't know if we've even talked about this before, but I've had a lot of stuff that got away from the other way around, you know, so we've done it as a podcast to demonstrate that it's got, so the thing we're making at the moment for the BBC called The Good, The Bad and The Unexpected, which is a comedy panel show, we started that off as a podcast. And then that meant that we could sort of iron out, because commissioners are so very risk averse, you know, so if you can show that you have got an idea that we, you know, did it in front of a live audience and that it could find that people like it, it's got a format and it's got, you know, you can find an audience, then you've got a much better chance of it being commissioned.
Of course.
I've done that with our Live at the Stand, as I talked about earlier, the show we make at the moment, The Good, The Bad and The Unexpected. But now, I don't know if I would do that so much now, because I just think we're much more experienced now. So where I'm sort of at this point, and I'm not saying this is going to change, because in the past we've been at various, and this has got nothing to do with anything particularly, just at this point in our, in the career and the evolution of my company, is that we wouldn't probably do anything for nothing, you know. So just because we've got a busy enough, we're busy enough with the stuff that we've had commissioned. But that always changes, you know. We've just been on a run like that for about 3 or 4 years now. But I can see that changing in the coming years. So if we were in that position, then maybe we would go back to making something to sort of prove concept. But no, and also I've also been like that. You know, a lot of people talk about podcasts and making podcasts, and yes. But when we've made podcasts, we've tended to make them for somebody, so therefore get paid to make them.
Right.
So we were paid by The Guardian to make their Edinburgh Festival coverage. Mm-hmm. We were paid by Amnesty International to make a version of the Secret Policeman's Ball mm-hmm. at the Edinburgh Festival called the Secret Comedy Podcast. You know, we were paid by the Pleasants to make their comedy podcasts and digital TV, Pleasants TV and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We worked with the Pleasants to find a sponsor, you know, but mm-hmm. we were getting, do you know what I mean? So yeah. It's been a while since we've done something for nothing to prove a concept, but I think we've done it before and that has led to us getting stuff commissioned mm-hmm. and I think it's very worthwhile doing.
Yeah.
But this kind of thing, I mean, you know, your podcast here is interesting because it's an Ask the Industry podcast, so it's an industry facing thing. So that's, you know, the audience you're looking for is people who are in the comedy industry mm. is interesting. But I mean, I think that, you know, I can't bring myself to listen to sort of two comedians talking.
No.
Anymore.
Because there's
just too many of them.
When I started this, I got Stu around my flat, Stu Goldsmith, yeah. who runs Comcom Pod.
Yeah.
And I said to him, I had an idea to start this. And I heard the first episode of yours and I was worried that it's going to cross over
yeah.
and it's going to be a problem. And I didn't want to tread on his toes. He was more established. He still is, you know, more established than me.
Yeah.
And I said to him, I'd listen to Tim Ferriss's podcast, the 4-Hour Workweek guy. And I said, I want to do that, but for comedy. And he said, I got no interest in it. I wouldn't ask him about that at all. And he does now, yeah. but not as much, you know, as yeah. I do. And also I have... you know, he only invites comedians on. I invite, yeah. you know, I've got the booker for the Royal Albert Hall on next week. You know,
yeah.
I've got a diverse range of guests yeah. that are just, you know, people that I think are interesting.
Yeah.
And you say I'm looking for an audience. In many ways, when I started it, I thought no one would be interested in it.
Yeah.
And I thought no one would care because I was hanging out with people that were just content with where they were. And yeah. they were just sort of floating around on the open circuit in London. Yeah. And no disrespect, a couple of them are still there and they like what they do. They're happy with it. And if you're happy with it, you're happy with it. But there was part of me that was like, you know, my long-term plan is I want to have an audience.
Yeah.
And I'd love to be able to do, at the time, and you know, his name is something that we maybe shouldn't bring up too much, but Louis C.K. was a big hero of mine and he was doing yeah. that thing where he was making things and releasing it on his website.
Yeah, yeah.
And putting it out. And in my mind, I thought that's definitely the way this will go in the future. If you can't get on TV channels, or even if you don't want to have that censorship or that editorial, it will be the way that people will go. And that's, and then I saw Daniel Sloss and, oh, what's his name? I love his work and I can picture him. Not Dan Stade.
Tom Stade.
Yeah, they did that sitcom.
Yeah,
they put it online. Imuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, whether you like it or not, you know, it's. I thought it was the way it would go, and yeah. I still feel like a lot of people are going to do it
yeah.
that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you find that that's? Do you think that's yeah. going to be a threat?
Yeah. No, I don't think it's a threat. I think everybody you need to do it, go for yeah. it. But it's that making a living thing. You know,
yeah.
it's like you
yeah.
know how did they make a living out of Muff? You know, I thought it was great. I thought it was really funny, but I think it was funded by Daniel. You know, and so,
I think so. Yeah, but so, I think he did a Kickstarter for a chunk of it as well.
Yeah. So you know, so I mean, that's the. Look, I'm all for it. Do it. But you know how are you going to make a living from it?
Yeah, what do you
I want think to? That's really important. You know, it's really important to do that. Do you still like Louis C.K. now? Where do you stand on that?
Well, okay, so I still have a
when
lot.
When he came to Leeds,
I didn't buy a ticket.
Did you buy a ticket?
No, I didn't buy a ticket. I was sent a link by someone when they were still available, and I had no, like, there was no part of the movie was like, basically where I'm at with it is I think he's handled it badly. Mm-hmm. I think he hasn't apologised correctly. Mm-hmm. And I, at the time of recording, I don't know what he's going to do in the future. I think him leaking... So I saw a Joe Rogan podcast mm-hmm. where he said, I've spoken to Louis, and he says that his side hasn't been heard, and he says that there's no point in him saying his side because people have made up their minds. Mm-hmm. And I was like, A, I think people... I personally would like to hear your side if you think there's another side, mm-hmm. if you think there is.
Mm-hmm.
And B... As with anyone in this industry who I have a problem with because of their actions, I think you're entitled to seek work because you're a freelancer and that's the way it works. And it's then up to other people to decide whether they owe you their time and money to buy a ticket.
Uh-huh.
And as far as I'm concerned, I'm not going to be one of those that buys a ticket. Yeah. But if you want to go and see him, I might judge your decision, but I'm not going to, you know, we're all freelancers. So if you, there's people at this festival who I won't work for and won't work with because they've done stuff in the past that's questionable.
Yeah.
And, or not even questionable, you know, like just outright wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't think they've shown enough contrition or apologized to the people they've done wrong to.
Mm.
So, you know, why are you, were you a fan? Are you a?
I was a huge fan. Yeah.
Where do you stand on it?
it's just sort of just feels so let down, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think that's the thing about it, is just gutted, really, you know, that he could behave like that. And then, I mean, it's you know, it's like the thing, it's the sort of, I think it's funny, you know, listening to what you say about it there, it's an interesting thing. Just, you know, one of my favourite jokes was Norm Macdonald. Did you see him talk about Bill Cosby?
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about Bill Cosby, and he sort of said that everybody was like furious about Bill Cosby because, you know, of the hypocrisy. You know, the hypocrisy, the worst thing about it is the hypocrisy of Bill Cosby. That's the worst thing, is the hypocrisy. And you're like, well, and his joke is like, well, surely the worst thing is like the raping.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's the joke, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I feel a bit like that with Louis C.K. in the fact that, you know, it's a lot of like, I'm just so disappointed with the way he handled it, so disappointed about the fact that he didn't apologize properly, so disappointed, you know, but it's actually,
oh, yeah.
I'm just disappointed about what he did, you know,
yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
and that's what makes then what he says on stage, you know, when he says those horrible things on stage, it sort of felt like a joke. Now don't feel like a joke, you know.
Yeah.
So it sort of really makes you reevaluate him as a comedian. So I don't know. I just feel just sad, really. And it's the same way of like, you just go, oh shit, no, you know, you don't want to, you know, someone else to go, you know, sad that you can't start liking their stuff anymore. But
yeah.
I tell you what, I was with my friend the other day, and we watched Eddie Murphy Delirious on Netflix. Have you watched that recently?
I haven't seen it, no.
That has not stood the test of time.
Hasn't it?
Oh my God, you should watch it.
Okay.
Just watch it, like the first 5 minutes, you will not believe it. The homophobia, but like from the get-go, you know?
Yeah.
It's just like, wow. And the fact that it's that thing, like, which I think is an interesting decision of Netflix to just, it's there, right, boof, trending now, Eddie Murphy Delirious. Yeah. You switch, you press play on that, and the first 5 minutes is you're sitting there, like, jaw on the floor of his homophobia. That, and you're like, wow, okay, so is this... is this a thing where we go, well, it was of its time, you know, we judge it by of its time, so, you know, back then he didn't know it was wrong, so where do you then put that line in, you know, it's a fascinating decision that Netflix have made to, like, open, you know, poof, there it is.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that all these kids, you know, Jay Lafferty does a really good bit about it, stand-up bit about it, but it's the same, like, my daughter, who's now 12, nearly 13, is... you know, just watch the whole series of Friends. You're like,
yeah, because that's not fully stood up. Frasier has. I don't know if you've seen that. Yeah. Frasier was handled very well.
Yeah.
I know what you... so they've got all Louis stuff still up on Netflix which is a really interesting to see. I mean, I think if you put enough clout and enough voices behind it going, we're appalled, they take it down. But
you should watch it. Honestly, anyone listening to this who's got Netflix, watch Eddie Murphy Delirious on Netflix.
Yeah.
Just watch the first 5 minutes and then ask yourself if you can ever... do you want to put it on now?
Do you want to do it now? Should we pause it and do it?
Let's pause it and do it, right?
On,
and if you're listening to this, do the same. Get Netflix.
Right. Pausing this. While me and Richard go off and watch the first few minutes of Eddie Murphy's Delirious Netflix special, I want to take a minute and tell you that there are a few tickets left for our second festival meet and greet in London. If you're hoping to tour or preview a show, it is an invaluable chance for you to get in front of the people who book festivals from around the country. It's a donation-based event. I'm suggesting £5 and upwards. There is a link in the show notes. Here comes your mid-rollout.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And we're back. If you're fed up of getting ads in the middle of the pod, you can get ad-free versions of the show by becoming a Patreon from just $1 an episode. If you think these shows are worth $1 or 80p or more, you can give more than a dollar. Please do consider supporting this show and me to keep it going. You can do it as a one-off payment via PayPal, or you can become a regular subscriber via Patreon. Both of these links are in the show notes. I massively appreciate anyone and everyone who does it. Me and Past Richard have now watched the first few minutes of Eddie Murphy's Delirious. There'll be no surprises our response to some of the material, but it does spark some very interesting conversations about Netflix, online content, and how it will live forever. Let's dive back in.
Hello. We're back.
Yeah. 3 minutes of Eddie Murphy there.
I was tempted to record it on audio, but I think I'd get some sort of strike or whatever, but...
Yeah, and also you wouldn't want to put that on this.
No, not at all. Well, I didn't know ahead of time.
Yeah.
The only thing you've said so far before we get back into it is you've said it's on the homepage of Netflix.
Yeah.
Which was the thing that shocked you. I even said to you, I was like, it sounds like they've added that laughter. Because I don't want to repeat any of the lines.
No, you don't, but it's like rampantly from the outset.
Because I'm worried.
Opening line, homophobic lines, using the worst words for homosexual people.
Yeah, it's not even like he's hiding.
And you hope it's sort of building to something.
Yeah, that's the one thing I was hoping.
And the argument is, it's of its time. This is what made him famous. This is what made him Eddie Murphy. This is why everybody loved Eddie Murphy. I remember seeing the other one, Raw, which I think came after Delirious, when I was about 13 or 14, and thinking it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen.
Right.
I can remember one of the... he was doing it in LA. One of the opening jokes, was... I can remember it as well. It was about police sirens, and they just had people sitting on top of the car going, woo, woo, woo. Oh, right, that was the opening joke. And then I can remember.
Well, that's a lot sillier in like a playful way than what
still
he's saying.
The language he was using,
I know,
though,
but
the same.
But comparison to that opening joke, that's at least him playing with a silliness of it. But with that, I mean,
it's shocking, isn't it? Don't you think it's shocking?
Shocking's the wrong word, because shocking implies that like that's the first time I've heard something like that, and it's like telling him, because I've heard homophobic things like that before. What's making me uncomfortable about it is the fact that... So I'm 1986, is my birth year, and I've never seen that before. I've only seen him in... I've seen him do Donkey and, Shrek, and, I've seen him do a load of
Beverly
films
Hills
and stuff.
Cop,
I've seen that sort of... So for context, I've never seen that, but I knew he was famous when I first came in contact with him. And so it feels odd...
Yeah.
That's what made him famous.
That was him at the peak of his powers as well. I mean,
as a comedian,
the opening shots of that are him on a private jet arriving at the gig. It's a sold out massive theatre.
Yeah.
Him doing his HBO special, and like he's already super famous, and that's launching him into his movie career and being an absolute A-lister.
Yeah.
On every chat show, darling of every chat show.
I get the argument. It's of its time. Mm. I understand.
I'm not arguing.
No. I'm not saying you're arguing that at all. I'm saying I get why people argue that, and I understand that. As a society, we often move our moral goalposts.
Yes.
And we also change language. Like that's how all language has always evolved.
Yes. So
it's not unheard of for someone to change their opinion, or for the world,
world to change its
exactly.
opinion. Exactly.
But it's. For you to, he can say anything in that, like they've paid to see him. They don't know what it's a weird thing about comedy is you generally pay and you don't know what you're going to see. You just know you're going to see that person or you're going to see a theme of a thing. Because that show, I don't know what the description of it is. Mm. Sometimes you'll go and see a themed show, so you'll know roughly what you're seeing.
Yeah.
But with comedy, it's the rare thing with a play, you might know the plot but with comedy, you don't. So he can say anything and he's opted to come out and say that. And for an online distributor to plug that as new.
Yeah, I know, it's crazy. But I think it's Eddie Murphy Delirious. If you know comedy, you know that's what it was. Everybody knows that.
So, I heard of it. I've just never seen it.
And like, yeah. He's just on the most recent Jerry Seinfeld Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Yeah, there's an episode with him. Yeah. And Jerry obviously knows what he was like. They worked together. They did all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I just suppose, for me, the thought of it being promoted so heavily by Netflix is an interesting choice. And maybe it's not being. Maybe it's just my algorithms.
Yeah, maybe.
Because I watch a lot of stand-up.
Actually, too. Well, let me... I'll tell you what, so I'll log in mine and see if it comes up on my... See, it's trending.
We'll do that,
on your, it's trending on yours. I will edit this podcast quite heavily because there's a lot of pauses and moving around. Yeah. So I'm going to log in. So I'm logging on my Netflix on my phone and it's on trending, you're saying. So
yeah,
here
it was
we go.
On...
Emmy Award trending now. So I'll show you on my phone. I've got...
I had it on new, like new this week.
That's Comedians in Cars. Maybe it is your algorithm then because it's not coming up on mine. That's the thing. Maybe if I click comedy... This is going to be a fun edit. I can't see him on there on mine. That's interesting. So maybe it is. Maybe you just watch a lot of... Because I don't really watch that many specials. Yeah. So maybe if you watch more specials, it might be on there for you.
I watched the first 5 minutes of lots of
specials. Wait, no, hang on. Here we go. That's the Comedians in Cars.
That's him again. Oh, well.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, the point... No, I can't see it.
It's new on Netflix and they're promoting it.
They are definitely promoting it because I have seen it come up on my Netflix, but it's not on trending on mine. Yeah. So. It's interesting because YouTube censors their trending page.
Right.
So that's why when you were saying that, I was thinking you were going to mention that because, you know, YouTube, if your content is not monetizable, they don't use it on the page because what's the point in them getting more views when they're not going to be able to put ads on it?
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah, so it's their business model. It makes sense. Yeah. But it does mean that if you have a really interesting, say, conspiracy theory video, I watch a fair number of those.
You can't
get it out to anyone except for through Reddit, probably.
Right. Okay.
That's the main thing. Okay. That that's thrown me for six, really.
I know it's nuts, absolutely nuts.
But as I said to you, you know, that brings me on nicely to I've been asked recently a lot by Scottish people in particular about morals in comedy and about how a lot of people are showing their morals or they're trying to seem more I think Hannah Gadsby has had like an impact on that in that sort of area. And obviously if everything's going to live online,
I thought we were talking about comedy.
Oh, sorry. Did you not like her?
No, I thought it was great. I mean, I really enjoyed watching it, but it was a spoken word piece.
I got as far as when she started to talk about why she doesn't want to do comedy anymore.
I thought it was fantastic.
And I stopped watching because I felt too... I haven't watched the rest of it.
I thought it was really good, brilliantly observed. And her experience is horrific. And I thought what she had to say was powerful, brilliant, meaningful.
Not comedy.
I was hooked. I watched every minute of it. I loved it. Absolutely loved it, but it wasn't comedy.
Yep.
You know, and I'll tell you the story of two stories, right? And I'm not going to defend either of these people. But a couple of years ago, I sort of produced and directed Terry Alderton's show, and we ended up winning the Malcolm Hardy Award for Comic Innovation that year. We had the comedy judges, it was the year Hannah Gadsby won it, and we had the comedy judges come in to see Terry's show. 9 times they came to see it, and on the night before the nominations were announced, like 3 of them came, 2 people who were up from London, and then we didn't get nominated for it, and that was that, right? Mm-hmm. And it gave us this sort of feeling of that we'd lost, you know, which is a horrible feeling because awards are utterly meaningless unless you win it, and then most important thing ever.
Yep.
But the point is it just reminded me of comedy critics, judges of these awards, and these kind of things. And I met Jim Davidson a few years ago. And Jim Davidson...
At the Fringe. Okay.
And he did a full run at the Fringe.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about his... You know, it was very interesting the way he was talking, actually. Because he has got a reputation for being racist, misogynist, that kind of thing. And I was in a radio studio waiting to go on. And there was a lot of young, new comedians in the play. And him... And he said, I tell you, he was there. Lucy Beaumont was there. Sean Walsh was there. Someone else. I think another Beaumont, or it was another Lucy, but I can't remember. But they were there, and we were waiting to do. I was producing a show with Christian O'Connell for Five Live, and Jim Davidson was a guest. And they were all sitting there, and you could see everybody was really bristled about the fact that they're in this room with Jim Davidson, and it was like, it's just uncomfortable because all the new young comedians, they did, because that was a few years ago, so they were new young comedians at the time, didn't quite know where to put themselves. Mm-hmm. And Jim told us, and I started speaking to him, and I said, how's it going? He goes, well, it's fine. He goes, you know, but my audience are just not a fringe audience. You know, the people who come to see Jim Davidson are not people who come see fringe shows. So I'm doing the assembly rooms, and I do my show, and then on after me is Jason Byrne, and Jason Byrne's audience are queuing up to come in as my audience go out. And he goes, and seeing his audience waiting to go in and seeing my audience waiting to go out, it's like seeing the Pakistanis and the Indians in the disputed Kashmiri territory. Everybody did what you just did, which was like, oh, and hearing Jim Davidson say those words, you're like, oh, hang on. But then you're like, actually, that's a very nuanced observation that's not racist in any way, shape or form. Because there's a lot of tension between the Pakistanis and the Indians in the disputed Kashmiri territory.
I think it again comes down to his intent on that metaphor rather than like what.
Well, what was his intent?
I don't know. But because I assume, because I've never met him, exactly, that he's racist. Exactly. I assume that he's trying to say something else and there's going to be something else coming.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And everybody just, whoa, clenched. Right. Me too. I mean, me too. And it was, and I was like, huh, all right. Oh, God. And like, I don't like this guy. You know, I never thought, I knew I didn't like him. And you see, everybody in the room did the same thing, you know, but it wasn't until afterwards that I started thinking about it. I was going, well, why did he say those? Why did he choose that? You know, what was his, was he deliberate? Is he clever enough to be deliberately sort of messing with our expectations of him? You know, and then it made me think, and this is back to Hannah Gadsby. This is what it made me think about like these awards and these comedy awards. Jim Davidson that year was reviewed in the Telegraph or the Guardian. I think it was the Guardian. And they said, this is exactly what the review said. Jim Davidson's show was designed to crank out punchlines. The audience were left breathless with laughter. At the end, they gave him a standing ovation, at which point I couldn't decide who I hated more, them or him. And the same reviewer gave Hannah Gadsby a review saying, when comedy is this important, the fact it's not funny doesn't matter. And okay. I was like, well, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
We're not doing it for the people who are choosing awards and who are writing reviews and are being critics. I mean, how does that make you feel? I can't work out who I hated more, them or him. And when comedy's this important, the fact it's not funny doesn't matter.
It reminds me of a conversation I had last year with someone who got annoyed that they had a newcomer judge come to see them twice. Uh-huh. And not as many, but still, you know, more than once means they're interested.
Yeah.
And they said, I don't know why I haven't been nominated. I don't know why they would come twice if they're not going to do it. And I said, well, they've got an agenda. They've got, you know, they're doing what they're doing. And it's the same thing with reviewers. I think reviewers are competing in a clickbait society. Mm-hmm. Reviewers ultimately want to discover the next something. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of looking for that more than they're actually looking for the funniest. Mm-hmm. And they're also, you know, they want their name on a poster. So sometimes they'll give a little snappy line.
Yeah, yeah.
Which means that their name gets out there more, which means they become more valuable, which means that they get more jobs as a reviewer. Yeah. So you know, they have their own agenda as to why they write things in the way they do, in the same way we write things in the way we do. Because, you know, if you want to say something in a provocative way like he did, he's going to get, if that had happened now, he would get 20 headlines on a newspaper that would talk about his, you know, thoughts on the you know, areas in the world and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So it makes me, and in terms of comedy is what I think you're asking.
But like in terms of that, those reviews, I mean, you know, like if his show was designed to crank out punchlines.
The
audience were left breathless with laughter.
I said to my friend,
he got a standing ovation, at which point I couldn't work out who I hated more, them or him.
I had a chat with my friend the other day where I said to him, my biggest frustration this year is my show is just funny. And he said, why does that matter? And I said, because that's not enough for someone like me to be. Right. You know, I feel like it's got to have a hook. It's got to have a sentence. It's got to have something to it. And he was like, but if it's funny, it's going really well. So it's stuff like that that fucks with your mind as a performer.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
Because you go, I got reviewed as an acquired taste a while ago.
Okay.
And I'm like, surely every performer is an acquired taste. You know?
Absolutely.
It just seems weird. I didn't like it at first, but now, you know.
Yeah. It's cool.
I take your review board, my baby. I throw it back at you.
Yeah.
But when comedy is this important, the fact it's not funny doesn't matter. Again, that fucks with you where you go, okay, well, let's take everyone who's got an inspiring story. And there's a lot of people on this circuit who have got a different life experience to me, who have an important message and have an important thing to say, and I'm not discounting it at all. But I think if you're going to put it in the comedy section, it needs to be funny.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I mean, I thought Hannah Gatsby's show was brilliant. I really did. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. But it wasn't comedy. That was. I think lots of people think the same.
Yyeah. But then they said that about Richard Gadd. Richard Gadd even said it in his show, where he did. He said it at the end. He said, "My biggest mistake with this was putting it in the comedy section."
Yeah, but it was very funny.
It depends on how you see it. Because I went and saw it at the Soho with my friend who couldn't make it to Edinburgh, and she cried for most of the show. She didn't laugh once. Yeah. So again, it's subjective because I found some bits funny as well, but it wasn't as Jim Davison's would have been punch, 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 because that's his style.
Yeah, yeah.
And that wasn't what Richard was going for with that show at all. He was talking about something very serious, and so
I think it was funny. I mean, we just did a Radio 4 show with Richard Gadd. You know, he's very funny, and you know, I thought it was full of jokes.
I've seen him do other stuff, and I think he's very funny. Yeah. But that specific show, I'm saying, I took a friend to.
Yeah.
And she largely cried for it and told me afterwards she doesn't remember laughing once. And I said to her, I didn't hear you laugh once.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about, and he won that award.
Yeah, the same in the Edinburgh Comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's Hannah Gatsby.
That's what I'm saying. So. When I think of awards and when I think of reviewers and things, I have to remember they've got agendas.
Yeah.
And something like Richard Gadd's show or Hannah Gatsby's show could easily make it to Netflix or could easily make it as a radio show, as you've done, and move a lot easier than, say, for example, imagine
a one... Richard Gadd's show was different, by the way.
I'm saying it could have.
I think he did do it on TV, I think.
Yeah, I'm saying, as I think you'd agree, it definitely could have gone.
Yeah.
Jimmy Carr came up and was doing that. You know, I have friends who do one-liners now, and it's immensely harder for them now to be seen as unique or interesting or anything like that, even if they're hilariously funny, because it's hard to break that.
Gary Delaney and Tim Vine.
And,
exactly. Well, I used to do stand-up, you know, and I retired from doing stand-up because of it was a phenomenal lack of demand that made me retire from doing stand-up.
You'd think that would stop a lot of others.
Yeah. But one of the main reasons I stopped for doing stand-up was, you know, I'm a 45-year-old white man with a posh voice who has kids, you know, and I was wearing, you know, a suit jacket and a shirt and talking, and I was fine. I got to the point, I got booked to do some big gigs, and I did, you know, was doing... I got to the stage of doing opening 15s at the weekends at the Stand. That's where I worked. It took me about 2.5-3 years to get to that point. I was doing opening weekends, and I was getting booked to do openings, you know, opening 15s. And I got to this point where I was like, nobody needs any more of this, because there's so many people who are doing this better. And I don't have anything particularly to say. And I am always, however, firstly, it's too much like hard work and I couldn't be bothered. And secondly, I've got such respect for the craft, such respect for the art, that you have to work all the time to do it. And I wasn't that bothered. And I got away with doing stand-up because I looked like a stand-up comedian. I sounded like a stand-up comedian. I had the rhythm of a stand-up comedian, and I talked about things that audiences were very comfortable with, like, isn't it, you wouldn't believe what my daughter said this morning, and like, you know, take my wife, you know, that kind of stuff, and people liked it, but it was ultimately incredibly boring, because there's people who are doing that much, 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 much better, and like, I mean, every stand-up comedian that you can think of off the telly, you know, Michael McIntyre, Lee Mack, John Bishop, you know, that's what they do, you know, sit there and do the everyman, family man stuff, you know. So that's entirely why I gave up.
This was a debate.
But that's the point with your one-liner friends. Is like, we've got Tim Vine, we've got Gary Delaney, we've got Jimmy Carr, so you need to be fucking good if you're going to go into that marketplace.
Exactly.
You know?
I mean, this was the debate I had with my director when I first, he came and saw me, and he said, what do you want from me, kind of thing. And I said, I think my biggest problem is there's a lot of
like,
I don't know what why I'm unique, and he was just like, I go and see a lot of these people, invite me to see loads of them and stuff, and I don't work with everyone, and I want, you know, he gave me like quite a boost about that, and like you said, he said, here are your problems, and like you said, you know, if you got a rhythm of a comedian, a lot of people could take a written joke, but you know, there's loads of comedians who have jokes written for them and stuff, and then they just regurgitate it, and that's fine, you know. I'm not dissing people that do that at all. If that's what they want to do and that's how they want to do it, that's fine. But for me, it's not interesting. And in terms of going back to sort of you know, online content and this sort of thing, stuff lives out there forever now. So if you were doing stand up now, even if you did one gig now, somewhere, even on the CCTV at the Stand, there would be a record of it that could go on the internet at some point. and live forever. And I suppose going back to maybe the question, who we work with and if they're questionable things, although that promoter in Leeds made their decision, I think they're still
Louis C.K.
They're still going to be having that thing, and so they still have a job, and they're still going to have a job, because I think that will fade because of the memory of things on the live circuit is a lot less, whereas if it's online it can be, you know, you can watch it 100 times and it will fade. So I suppose what my question is, how do you, and you said like some stuff doesn't get burned when they do it on stuff on radio and things, so how do you decide morally when you're working with people or when you're casting for things, like what's, you know, how do you look back in their catalogue and be like, have they ever made a joke that is questionable, or is there, you know, if
that's a good question actually. No, because I think like, I don't think you, there's like, we were watching the Eddie Murphy thing there and were shocked by the language he was using, right? And I think, like, if he was to say stuff like that now on stage, would he get arrested? I mean, is that hate speech?
I think, I know, because I think there's a clause in hate speech if it's done in, like, a context of a performance.
Yeah. For me, like, I mean, I just would judge somebody if they're funny, you know? I wouldn't have a problem with stuff that they've said. I know so many comedians, myself included, when I did it, but so many people who've tried stuff and it's gone wrong, hasn't quite worked, they've not got found the line, they're trying to get right to that point and they've just misjudged it the first couple of, you know? And even you think back to jokes, famous comedians now doing jokes, like Jimmy Carr, one of his big most famous jokes when he first started, basically a rape joke, you know, and when you think about it now, it's like, I can remember the joke. It was like, on the subject of anal sex, I always find it's much easier to get forgiveness than permission. And that was one of his like really early jokes, and it, like, at the time it's hilarious. I mean, the same with Frankie Boyle, like when he, like, his jokes back right at the very start were like, oh my god, you know, it's like so shocking, whereas you wouldn't broadcast stuff like that on the radio, obviously. But so in terms of like the only, like, I don't have any moral problems with what anybody has to say if they're trying to be funny. If they're trying to make a joke, the problem goes when they're getting it wrong, consistently getting it wrong, you know. And even then, you know, it just, is it funny, does it work, is it good, you know, then those are the things that are the most interesting things. The problem I've got is if somebody has broken the law, you know, and that's a total thing just with broadcasting rules on the BBC. We can't have somebody who is, you know, been arrested or has an ongoing case, or there's, you know, something off stage more usually than on stage, you know, so somebody who's, you know, so that's where we have problems with people. But no, I don't have any problems morally with what people are trying to do or trying to say, and all I want is a really funny 5-minute bit, you know. That's mostly for the shows we're looking for, is really funny 5-minute bits, you know. So I think my point about morals, you know, you ask about that, is that I think I'm happy, I'm completely understanding of people who try stuff and get it wrong, who try comedy and get it wrong. I'm not going to judge anybody for having said something on stage that, you know, has maybe not stood the test of time, is maybe really icky, is maybe, you know, as long as they've learned that, realized it and grown, you know, and know the difference between what you can say on TV and radio and what you can't say on TV and radio. I mean, loads of comics perform on TV and radio who say horrific things, you know, in their club sets, and in, even just go back 5-10 years, they've said loads of horrific things. Anyway, that's my thought. So morally, I've got no problem with what, as long as that people are trying to be funny, that's the whole point. If they're trying to make a joke, then you can do anything you want, you know. It's that whole thing of, you don't know, you don't have the right to not be offended.
Yes,
you know, that's the thing, because I might be completely offended by green microphone cables. You've got a green microphone cable, and, you know, maybe my son, you know, died when he swallowed a green microphone cable, and now I'm sitting here and you bring to my house a green microphone cable, like, that is the most offensive thing you can do to me, you know, what the fuck are you thinking? But I actually don't have the right to not be offended by a green microphone cable.
Phew. Yeah, thank God for that.
It didn't happen.
No, that's right.
It was a purple one.
Oh good, well, I'm glad I went with red and green. My next questions were going to be on success.
Yes.
And how you measure success.
Yes.
Because I think we've got out of that area of time where it's all about the numbers.
Yeah.
I think there was a time where, you know, everyone was always like, oh, this got 1 million downloads, or this got 5,000 retweets, or whatever. You know, like, there's still a good measure.
Yeah.
But I think there are other success measurements. And I wondered, when you're working with the BBC, or when you're working on a podcast, when you've done them, what was your measures of success? And maybe if you take like a specific show and say, we were aiming for this, or long term we're aiming for this.
That's a good question. I suppose, you know, like with radio stuff, I mean, one of the measures of success, I suppose, would be, you know, do the audience like it? You know, do people get in touch with us to comment on it? Do Does it make people laugh? And with a program, so would you get commissioned for a second series? Would be a measure of success. I mean, generally in the industry, how do you measure success? I think if you set out to be a professional comedian or a professional program maker, then, you know, are you making a living? You know, that it's as simple as that. You know, if you're a stand-up comic, then I think you need to be a successful stand-up comic. I think one of the measures of whether you're a successful stand-up comic is if you can do it and make a living from it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's other measures of success of, you know, are you saying something interesting? Are you, you know, staying true to your visions and goals? You know, then you can measure success in those ways. But for us, success, I suppose, is the audience enjoying it, people laughing at it, and us getting the chance to do more of it. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've done plenty of failed pilots, you know, where we've made a pilot and it's gone no further than the pilot, you know. So in some cases you would then ask, has that project been a failure? But maybe not, because it's led to the next thing, you know.
You learn from it.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's just, success is, are we still getting to do it? Mm-hmm. Are we getting asked to do more? Are we still invited to the meetings? Are we still getting programs commissioned? So I suppose, and are we all making a living? And I suppose those are the ways of measuring success in one sense. The other sense for me is, are we also staying true to making the programs we wanted to make, what we set out to make? You know, that's like what I said right at the beginning of this, is I don't want to just be a producer. You know, I want to be a program maker that makes programs that I really like. With people I really like, on ideas that I really believe in. And if we're doing that and making a living, then I think that's a success. I mean, we could always be doing more, you know, and there's you know, everything that, you know, I think the last program we made is the best program we've ever made, and I've thought that for a while. You know, everything that we do, we're trying to get better at, you know, trying to make it better, make it look better, sound better, be funnier, you know. So
two last questions then before we do the quick fire ones.
Okay.
Could you run everyone through I mean obviously there's no average commissioning route,
yes,
or how something gets made, but like a sort of staggered path of,
yes,
how, once you've got the idea,
yes,
how long it takes,
yes,
when something gets made,
yes,
you know, when you get actually paid for your actual, yes, work rather than the whole thing, so that people know, okay, what it's like for an independent, because I've done it for in-house when it's like, okay, BBC Studios, and I'm wondering what the, okay, difference between the two is.
Well, I'll talk would you like me to talk specifically about Radio 4?
You can even do a show if you want, like, you,
okay,
want,
the, yeah, Radio 4 commissioning process is they do a commissioning round once a year, which is their main commissioning round. They have a kind of top-up round later on in the year, and they also have an ad hoc bit where you can, you know, there's other things, but the main thing is a commissioning round once a year. Before, when they launch their commissioning document, which is online, everybody can see it, they say the sorts of programs they're looking for, and the sorts of things they're not looking for, and then they would have a commissioning briefing that you can go to where the commissioner will talk through that document, basically. Then,
is that open to everyone?
It's open to everyone, but you have to be on the approved suppliers, yep, list to be able to put an idea in, which is why individuals who have ideas need to approach production companies, mm-hmm, and then production companies can take those ideas forward. Mm-hmm. After that, you've then got about 6 weeks to put in your idea in a 250-word paragraph. Mm-hmm. So whatever the idea is, you have to write up in 250 words, and then you submit that to the website, and then you wait from that point about 4 weeks. And then after 4 weeks, they either reject or re-request, right? And then if you get your idea re-requested, that means you've made it onto the shortlist. So you might have four things at this point that are on the shortlist. Now you'll go and have a meeting with the commissioner. You'll talk through those four ideas. They'll say, oh, I like it from this angle, that kind of stuff. And then you've got another kind of 2 or 3 weeks to put together the idea as like maybe 2 pages, mm-hmm, maybe a sort of sample of script, or maybe a sort of sample running order, you know, and a couple of pages with, you know, much flesh the idea out. Then you put that into the website by a deadline, and then you wait maybe 3 months. Mm-hmm. And then after 3 months, they announce what they're commissioning for the following year. So we have just put stuff into the commissioning round in January. It was shortlisted at the end of February. We then had to put the full idea in by the end of March. And then by the end of July, they're going to tell you what's being commissioned. And that's for the 2021 financial year. Mm-hmm. So it's for stuff after next April. So we'll find out now what we'll be making this time next year.
when you say they'll let you know, mm-hmm. do you mean they email you, or you mean they put a press release out?
No, they don't put a press release out until everybody's signed the contracts right. and secured the talent and all that stuff. Everyone will get an email to say the results have been published on this mm-hmm. website called Proteus, and you log on to the website to see what the results are. Then after that, they then say, this is the money, does that suit you? And then you say yes or no, and then you get a contract. And then once you've signed the contract and secured the talent, then they might then put you in a press release. But they don't always put everything in a press release. They put some of the big things. And then sometimes if you make something that's a success, then you just get it commissioned anyway, recommissioned. Mm-hmm. You know, so we just made a show with Suggs, mm-hmm. With Paul Weller and Boy George and Jazzy B. And I don't know if I can say that. But yeah, I think we're going to get, this is going to go out after the summer.
It will be September.
Yeah, yeah. We've got our second series of that commissioned. So we found out about that, sort of out with that. So yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's the process for Radio 4. TV commissioning is different again, because they do have commissioning rounds. Mm-hmm. But when we got our TV show commissioned on BBC Scotland, you know, we kind of had a lot of meetings, talked a lot, had to put together a little taster tape, you know, that kind of mm-hmm. thing. And then I ultimately got the thing commissioned. Going back to Radio 4, and you talked about the money, when you sign the contract, you get paid 50% of the money. Right. And then when you finish the program and it's been broadcast, you get the other 50%. Right. So that can sometimes be 14, 15, 16 months between the two payments.
So up until the point of you even finding out you've got the show, you've not got paid for any of that
nothing,
work?
No, nothing at all. Right. No, you only get paid for what you get commissioned.
Okay.
So yeah, nothing at all.
So if you pitched like 10 shows and that took, you know, yeah. like 6 months of hard work and whatever, and you get none of it, you've got no money?
No, not at all. No. You only get paid for what you get commissioned, yeah.
Right.
Which is why the in-house BBC team are getting paid every day, aren't they? So, you know, but I think that's fine. That's their job. But you know, so the budget for a half an hour show on Radio 4 can be £10,000-£12,000, you know. So if you get, you know, let's say you get 20 half-hour shows commissioned by Radio 4, you know, that's £250,000 worth of money, you know. So, I mean, it costs a lot of money to make the shows, but you know, one of the things I think production companies factor in is, you know, from that money, you know, there's going to be an element of that that is going to go towards your company's development costs, you know. And you look at every project like that, you know, you skim a bit of money off each project that goes into the production company for development, because yeah, my main job in my company is developing ideas and getting stuff commissioned. The rest of the team actually make them, you know, are the people who are editing and technical and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Is the BBC have a lot of facilities in-house to make shows? Yeah. Do you go in and make them there, or do you make them here? Like, how does an independent production house work?
That's a good question. It depends on the show. I mean, we do most of the stuff we do is in front of a live audience. So we hire a space and then we go and record in that space, ranging from the Stand Comedy Club, the Monkey Barrel, the Gilded Balloon, to BBC's facilities. When it comes to stuff we do inside a radio studio, then we would hire a studio. We've got a studio we work with in Edinburgh and a studio we work with in Glasgow, but we wouldn't use BBC facilities. But in terms of, you know, nowadays, you know, what you need to make a radio show, I mean, you're not far off it here with what we're sat in my living room. But, you know, we can go into a venue and with 2 flight cases and 2 laptops and make a radio show. Whereas before, you used to have to turn up with a lorry, you know, to do that kind of thing. So, and in terms of being in a studio, then you can hire a studio. So as an independent production company, I would argue that you don't need that much kit. Mm. You just need the idea. And once you've got the commission, then you would then hire what you need.
Yeah.
So we would be available, for example, if there's a company that said, we've got this commission and we need to record this show in front of an audience, could you come and record it for us? Then we could, that would be yes, we could, because we've got that kit to do that, right. You know. And then also in the kitchen there, we've got a full TV studio. I mean, we do, in my office next door, one of our clients is Highlands and Islands Enterprises, and we do these live webinars, they're called, which are like a TV chat show for the tourist industry. So, and we have like a presenter and 2 guests, and it's me and Julia who present them together, and it's kind of a bit of like a really shit version of the One Show. But we've got that facility to do live internet broadcasting with like 4 HD cameras, and we can broadcast that to anywhere, you know, anywhere online. I've forgotten what your question was.
I just asked how you were.
I don't know. How am I?
The festival hasn't started, so I'm assuming you're fine.
Well, we got quite an easy festival this year, so it's not too stressful.
Now you're rubbing it in, I've got a stressful
one. Yeah, you've got a stressful one. I know, you've got it all to come. You'll be fine, though. You've done this before.
Fourth rodeo on this. It's a sixth festival, fourth solo show.
Well,
if anyone's listening, I'll leave links to the equipment I use, so that if you want to get a copy of it, feel free. I think it's fairly expensive.
The stuff I would say to anybody listening to this who wants to get something onto TV or radio, who's an individual, you know, an individual comedian, an individual writer, an individual is, you know, find a production company who makes the sort of stuff you like and get in touch with them. Listen to stuff on Radio 4, watch stuff on TV, see the name of the company at the end. You can always find that person and get in touch with them. And you might have to get in touch with them a number of times till they get back to you, you know, but if you've got, if it's a nice idea, you know, or invite, you like, you know, the way you go about it, Simon, is fantastic. You know, get to know people, invite them along to stuff, you know, and I'm sure that's the way. But just from an individual person's point of view is, you know, just get in touch with a company that's making stuff. You know, and that's the best way. And then from a production company point of view, is like all of us, there's enough work out there. There's so much work out there. There's so many channels. There's so many outlets. There's so many things. It's just, you know, collaborate. Collaborate with other companies and collaborate and, you know, grow and learn from each other. I think that's the way forward. And I'm 45 years old, but I think I'm an old dinosaur now. And there's probably 10 years left of this commissioning model, the way it works for channels, you know. And I'm sort of thinking I don't want to go down the route of making stuff that's square and subtitled and last 90 seconds.
I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I will. I'm going to say that what I've learned from this podcast and what I've learned from actually just going for a coffee with industry people, just to chat with them, not even like I haven't got anything I need to make right now, I just want to chat with them, is mostly money at a certain point is not a motivator. It's who you're working with. So, you know, that's the reason why I like to chat to people and meet with people, and actually not at like an event, you know, where there's like hundreds of people and we're all trying to work out, you know, it's weird, like this, or just meeting them at the festival and taking a minute to actually get to know them. Because for me, it's just like, you know, like you said, what's the point in email? Even if it was the best idea in the world, if you don't like the person or you don't want to work with them, it's not,
or it's not at the right time. I mean, for me, it's like we are so busy making programs most of the time, and then when it comes to commissioning rounds, it's quite often they're like, shit, we've got 3 weeks, what was it, hang on, where's that idea, you look through stuff, and it's so often it's down to timing, you know. That's it, it's luck, so much of it's luck. But also for us now, like I said before, for us now it's, you know, we're just trying to make the programs that we've already got, the people that are already in our kind of, you know, John Maloney, Fred McCauley, Julia Sutherland, Joe Caulfield, Janie Godley, Terry Alderton. It's like just trying to get them to the next stage with us, and that's a full-time enough job as it is.
These are the last quick fire questions. So quick fire for me, but you take as long as you like. Who was the first person in the industry to believe in you?
Keith Bunker. Well, that's an interesting question. Keith Bunker, when I was set up my independent production company, Jeff Zizinski, because he gave me my job at BBC Radio Scotland, and said, he was the guy who said, it's just all you need is a business card, headed notepaper, and a bit of brass neck and some good ideas. So, and he gave me my job at the BBC, which was key. And before that, a girl called Marsha Shandor, who did a podcast called Marsha Meets, and she now lives out in Canada. She gave me my very first job as a volunteer on Radio 4. So Marsha, Jeff Zizinski, and Keith Bunker. Those three people.
They got you here.
They got me here, absolutely.
What is an unpopular opinion you have about the comedy industry?
The unpopular opinion I have about the comedy industry is that 95% of people doing stand-up comedy are absolutely rubbish and should give up. And they are self-indulged, narcissistic. Self-indulged, narcissistic people who don't work hard enough. They're in it for drinking booze and the lifestyle. And most of them, most stand-up comedians I see are terrible. And I think they should stop doing it, put us all out of our misery. But the 5%, brilliant, life-changing. You know, they can, you know, change the opinion of a country. Mm. And that's, you know, are deep thinkers and philosophers, but the rest of them, there's just too many comedians, man. It's just too many comedians, and most of them just stop it. Please stop it. And audiences should stop encouraging them. I'll tell you another opinion I have that's very unpopular, is just because you can make an audience laugh doesn't mean you're a good comedian.
Yes, yep.
And I very much believe that, and I've had arguments with people about that a lot, you know. I mean, I think it's if you're booked to play a club at a weekend, your job is to make that audience laugh, right? And if you're good at making that audience laugh, then good on you. But it doesn't mean you're a good comedian.
No.
You know, I've seen so many people, you know, you've seen it yourself. Combears, oh, unfold your arms, you can't clap, you've got your arms folded. Are you in show business? No, take your feet off my stage. Well, look at this. It's like, we're looking at a really ugly boy band. Oh, what is it, you two? Go dressed at Brokeback Mountain. Blah. You know, and the audience are ending themselves laughing, you know. But these are terrible, terrible, terrible comedians.
Agreed.
What's the deal with Ryanair? Hey, it's like a boss with wings. Oh. You know, just stop it now. So those are that. I've got many more unpopular opinions, but I'll probably stop there.
That's okay. We can talk about them another time. What is the biggest mistake you've ever made and how did you overcome it?
Gosh, that is another good question.
So I'll save it till the end.
Yeah, the biggest mistake I've ever made. I mean, it depends, really. I mean, I've made some errors of judgment, you know, which have cost me a lot of money, but I've overcome that with sort of force of will and sort of keeping going. You know, like I've spent a lot of money on, you know, like I've certainly had a few financial missteps where I've put shows on at the fringe. Last year, we put a show on. I don't think Terry would mind me talking about this. We put the Terry Alderton show on. The year before, we'd done the Pleasance Cabaret Bar and we just busked it, really. And the next year, and we won an award and we got 5-star reviews and it went really well. It was amazing. And then we wrote a much better show and we came back and I was like, right, let's go for it. So we hired the best promoter you could imagine. We hired one of the most bulldogish PR people you could imagine. We got all the big posters all around town and we did a 300-seater at the Assembly Rooms, and at the end of it we lost about 12 grand, you know, maybe a bit more because of the amount of money we spent. And it just was one of those things, it felt like a mistake, you know, because we'd done fine the year before, you know, so we'd done fine without all that stuff the year before. So when we then went big, I don't know what it was, it just didn't quite, you know, a lot of the reviewers were like, oh yeah, we reviewed Terry last year, so we're not going to come and see him again. But we did get, we got a 5-star review in the Times on the second last day of the Fringe, you know. but I think, I don't know what it was, but it ended up costing a lot of money. And that felt like it was a mistake. But what we got out of that was we ended up getting some money from Sky to put together a script. We got a show on Radio 4, which we used it for a show on Radio 4 that just went on at 6:30, and we learned a lot from the process. So I think we overcame it by clawing some of the money back through commissions. I think it taught us a lesson of, you know, not necessarily being the right way to go about it for that type of show. So we decided to absolutely not do a show with Terry again this year because we were working on some other stuff and we were like, we won't bother. But we really enjoyed it last year and our kids are at that age where they could come and you know, and it just was cool. So we did a recording in Glasgow for the Radio 4 show about 3-5 weeks ago, and the next morning I got a phone call from David at the Monkey Barrel saying, oh, we've had a cancellation at 6 o'clock, do you want to come and do a show with Terry? So we are doing a show with Terry every day at 6 o'clock, but it's a pay what you want bucket show. So it cost us £250 for the room.
Okay.
And we've said no press, we've got no posters, we're going to hire a flyer us for 2 hours before the show, and that's it. And we're going to wait and see. So I think that'd be interesting to see this is probably the show that's going to win the Edinburgh Comedy Award and make us 10 grand.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, exactly, make it back. So that was, and then there's probably loads of mistakes, you know. I had a show going for a while that was doing really well and that I presented, and I did it as a podcast and it was the original sort of lunchtime live. It was the Guardian Live at the Gilded Balloon podcast, and we were doing this in 2008, 2009. It was a lunchtime show, chat show, and I hosted it, and no one else was doing that 12 years ago, you know. And so, and it was a fiver and everybody wanted to come on the show because it was getting hundreds of thousands of downloads back then. And then I kind of sold the idea to Amnesty International and they said they wanted another host to do it. So we kind of, which was fine. So we ended up like with, it was Susan Kalman hosted it. And then the next year we had various hosts and we did it for 2 years and it was kind of cool. But then Amnesty International ran out of money, so we stopped doing it. And I kind of wish I'd kept going doing that show, because I think it would have been, if I had, it'd be like the 10th year of it now. And we did it we ended up doing it in the Underbelly at sort of 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And we sold a lot of tickets, you know. It was one of those things and everybody wanted to come on it. And I did it for like 3 years running and it was growing. And I just think it could have been like Merv Stutter, you know. Merv Stutter, it could have become like that, but I sold out. Sold out to those human rights bastards at Amnesty International. We sold out, so I do regret that. But
they're not getting a link on my show. No, that'll take them down a peg.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
What do you wish you were better at?
Giving short, succinct answers.
So, what do you think you're great at?
I think what I've learned over the years is what I'm good is at gathering together experts and gathering together good people. I don't have any particular discernible skills, but what I do have is I know I can identify brilliant people, get them to work together on projects. I feel like that's the job of a really good producer, is to bring the right people together at the right time to do the right thing. And, you know, I think that came to the fore just recently when we were doing this project with Suggs from Madness, and we got Paul Weller involved to do a little bit of the show, and then my friend who I've worked with for years and years called Owen Parker came on and was the musical director, and then we went down to the Wilton's the Hoxton Hall in London, and I brought my team down to record it, and then we brought in this fantastic script editor, and it just felt like it was a big deal, and that felt like the culmination of everything I'd sort of worked towards. I almost feel like my job is like, in a football sense, I'm like the grounds. I just need to make sure that the grass is nice and green and cut well, and the lines are painted, and the goal nets are nice and tight, and that everybody's ready to play the game, and that sort of, you know, what my job is. So I think what I'm good at is bringing the right people together to do the right job.
What stumbling block have you learnt the biggest lesson from?
You know, I think it's the fact that, you know, rejection and failure is part of the process. You know, that you know getting knocked back is one of the most important things. You know, it sounds like a cliche, but there is no such thing as failure, really. You know, it was just something that didn't quite work at that time. You know, so I think it took me a while to learn that, but yeah, 99% of everything that you first that you try and do goes nowhere, but that's what teaches you to keep going. And then when you do get that glorious 1%, you know, you go, all right, this is why we do this, you know. And then that 99%, now we're working at a level where probably 40 or 50% of what we set about goes nowhere, you know. So 40, 50% of what we set about does go somewhere, because we're better at it, you know, we know what the client wants, and we know how to do it. And we know, partly because most of our business at this point is series two of this, series three of that, course, series four of that, you know. So anyway, so.
Best bit of advice you've ever been given?
Take risks and seek happiness.
Last question. If you could give one bit of advice to a few thousand comedians who want to either create some content or get something made by, you know, a production house to go forward to a BBC thing, what would you say to them?
Well, just do it. You know, I think it's like, I say this, it's like everybody, you can make a podcast on your phone just about, you know. So I don't know.
It's hell to edit.
Yeah, it is hell to edit. Yeah, I think the idea is, you know, keep going and keep doing it and keep creating, you know, and keep, you know, don't think about it from a commercial point of view. Don't think about it from a financial point of view. Think about it from a creative point of view. But be prepared to answer the question. Every question that you have is available to be answered online, right? How do you get a TV show on the BBC? Google it, right? Read a blog, listen to a podcast. Find out how to do it and do it. Another thing is that there is nothing in the world that you can't learn, right? So once you sort of get your head around that, I mean, heart surgery is probably tricky, but you can learn it though. You can learn it. I mean, I wouldn't do it off a YouTube tutorial, but you know, the person who does it learnt it. They haven't always known how to do it, you know. So it's like everything you can learn. So learn how to do whatever it is you want to do. Just learn how to do it. Be the funniest comedian on the circuit. Learn how to do it. Practice it. Get, you know, just keep learning. You know, you can learn how to change a plug. You know, you can learn how to grow a plant. You know, so therefore you can learn how to get a TV show commissioned. You can learn how to be a better comedian. You know, you can learn how to, you know, anything that you want. That, and then the other thing that freaks me out is that every single thing that you look at any point ever was at one point somebody's idea. So therefore, you know, just have as many ideas as possible. But everything, curtain pole, sofa, cushion, table, microphone, you know, go through it, mug, iPhone. It was all just somebody's idea once and they realized it. So therefore, think in that terms, what's your idea? And if you're shit, just stop.
Thank you very much for coming on. I really appreciate it. That was Richard. Having such an open and honest and frank conversation about comedy and how it changed over time, I loved it. I loved hearing the process of how radio gets made. I can't tell you enough how much I prefer radio
editing to anything else right now. I think that's pretty obvious given how much I podcast, but it was amazing. I listened back over to it a couple of times in the proof, and if you really sit down and do your research into this, there's actually a very handy guide in there if you want to set up a production company and get started making things for the BBC through your own means. I'm sure, and I hope some of you do actually do that. I'd highly recommend it. It's worth setting up your own thing if you can. It's why there are so many indie small production houses around. If you like this episode, you might also like the episode with Chris Sussman on the future of TV through BBC Studios, their commercial wing, or the episode with Henry Normal, the co-founder of Baby Cow Productions. They're most famous for everything to do with Steve Coogan, from Alan Partridge to Saxondale to the rest. The Ask the Industry podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening, thank you very much for subscribing, and thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.